Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I want to thank everyone for your help and support. I imagine there's probably never going to be a time where I don't need it. But for anybody, any of us that attempts to do this full time, which is the only way to do it, especially in an academic capacity, donations from my friends and supporters is really the only way to keep functional. You know, there's no room in academia for me. My student evaluations, which are the main way that a professor gets judged by students at the end of the semester after grades are in, are unheard of. I mean, they're all pinned to the highest level, even students that don't do well. I'm very good at what I do, and yet that's not enough. So that means people like me, in order to function, have to rely on people like you. And it's humbling in a good way and a bad way. But I want to continue to thank you for your support and during this time. When I started this show 10 years ago, I stressed something that was very essential to me. And the two related concepts were the old Orthodox, the old believers, and its relation to the revolutionary Petrine state, the state of Peter the Great, roughly around the turn of the 18th century. And how absolutely essential this was to the Orthodox Church, how essential it was to Russian and European history and the history of theology. I have a book out, Sobornosti, which I wrote a long time ago, which is still available. If you go to my site, you rusjournal.org, it could take you to the Hromada Press. It used to be on Deapara Press. Now is Hromada. Hromada is the Ukrainian word for community. And it's a small group that uses Lulu as their binder, and their most people are using Amazon now for that. But there's really, you know, the way that the publishing industry is changing, and this is how pretty much everyone's doing it. And they hold down costs to a great extent, and authors get to keep far more of their money than they used to. But even established publishers will use these kind of organizations, you know, Cafe Press and Amazon and all these other things, to do their financial stuff, to do the actual physical binding as well as the merchant interface. And it's so much easier that way. But I wrote that many, many years ago. It was, I believe, the first time I published a translation, because most of the literature on the Old Believers remains untranslated, as well as some of my own work in the field. There was an error. The initial editor of that book had a couple of things that were, he put as anonymous, which were, in fact, me. But that's all right. It's a humbling experience. So Essays on the Old Faith is still available, and this means that I've been spending a lot of time on the Old Believers. I'm very sympathetic to them. I've always been. They have this kind of national anarchism, this intense devotion to Sobornost, that really reminded the Russian Church what they truly are. As you know now, Catacomb synods in the Soviet era lifted all of the anathemas, and then I believe it was in the 70s, with the synod outside of Russia. Yeah, I believe it was St. Philaret. The synod outside of Russia lifted all of them. And of course, not too long afterwards, the Moscow Patriarchate did. Which is an odd thing to do. You know, we've tortured you, we've slaughtered you in huge numbers. Oh, sorry, we were wrong. You know, this is an odd thing to, you know, very quietly lift the anathemas as if to say, yeah, sorry, we slaughtered all of you and just for all the wrong reasons. It was destructive. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a lot like me. We part of the, you know, regular Russian Orthodox Church. I'm under the synod of the former Metropolitan Vitaly. Ustinov, bishop in Russia, and then which, to be honest with you, is I'm not saying it's not an old believer group. We have a lot of old believer people in it. And I mention that because there are some of us, Alexander Dugin, Solzhenitsyn, who are kind of on the border. We're part of the mainline church, Russian church, but we're highly sympathetic to the old belief and incorporate much of their vision into our daily work. The fact is, they were correct. They were right. Nikon was not the face of evil. Some of the priestless old believers, the sectarians, just got to the point where he was literally a demon in cassocks, and they made up stories that he had icons of Mary and Christ sewn into his slippers so he could step on them. I mean, ridiculous things like that. There is a phenomenon in social science. I'm not sure if anyone has actually named it yet, but when you are a part of a movement, a militant movement, of course you have to paint your opponents in the worst possible way. But when you go even deeper, when you drop out of society, or when you even kill someone in some guerrilla insurgency, you know, lose everything, what would happen if you were wrong? Well, what people will do is paint their opposition in such demonic terms that everything that they've done is justified. They have no choice in the matter. You know, if you are part of a militant group that has killed people, that is engaged in some kind of terrorism, you've dropped out of society, you've given up your life so you could be a part of this group, there is about 0% chance that you're going to suddenly say, oh, geez, I'm wrong. Sorry, I killed you. What's going to happen is that you're going to end up, you have no choice but to paint your opponent in absolutely demonic terms. And that's what happened with especially the priestless old believers and Nikon. The biggest problem with, by the way, the term old belief came from the court of Catherine the Great. Old Orthodox is usually the accepted term. There's nothing wrong with old believer, but talking with someone who doesn't really know can get confusing. In my prayer books I have from Erie, Pennsylvania, all have old Orthodox on it. All Orthodoxy is old. But there's a very close connection between the reforms of Tsar Alexis and Patriarch Nikon and then the rise of Peter the Great afterwards. I'm of the opinion that Peter really is close to a demonic figure, not Nikon. Nikon may have been wrong, but he didn't realize that. He couldn't possibly have foreseen the destruction that his reforms would cause. He didn't realize that some of the Greeks from the Middle East that he had in Moscow were phonies. You know, back then, it's easier to get away with. For me, the old belief was a revolt against the Petrian state, or the tendency that already existed in the 1660s and later to create the Petrian state. The pressures of modernity and Machiavellianism, Hobbesianism, weighed on Russia like it weighed anywhere else. It's irresistible to create a modern behemoth state and to be able to control it will infinitely increase your power. Of course, it's going to come at the expense of everything you are. So it is a Faustian bargain. I've argued on this show before that the man who came back from the Great Embassy probably wasn't Peter. You don't have to be able to read Russian for this. But the arguments were actually pretty good. And there were plenty of people. I mean, his wife didn't recognize him. And the behavioral change was so radical. And he hardly knew it was just, the evidence is actually pretty good. Whether he was murdered, whether he just abdicated, whatever it was, I have the feeling, I can't say this with absolute certainty, but I have the feeling that he was replaced. And the man who came back to Russia engaged in a revolution as severe as anything Lenin did. But of course, he was hemmed in by the technological limitations that, of course, Lenin didn't have. So my concern with the old believers is social. Now, for those of you who don't know, the old Orthodox were a national reaction, especially of the peasantry, to the existence of a Russian Empire rather than a Russian nation. Tsar Alexei and his patriarch Nikon had this vision of creating an Orthodox empire that would include the Middle East and parts of Greece and the Balkans. Because at that time, it was very clear that only Russia was the only functional state large enough to really protect Orthodoxy in any kind of a way. Orthodoxy was Russia at the time. But the larger this entity becomes, the more powerful it becomes, the more distant the state is from the population. To build an empire rather than a nation, and nations and empires are very, very different from each other, you have to have a ruling class. You have to have a class, and of course at the time, the ideas to create one came from the West. It came from Prussia, it came from Sweden, and to a lesser extent from the Netherlands and France. But Russia didn't know serfdom prior to this. The peasant commune contracted with landlords. It was a relatively equitable situation until Peter created the Western notion of that kind of peasant exploitation, which became very radical in the 18th century. It never reached the extremity of the Polish version. But Russia generally had a free peasantry. We're going to get to what the Russian word for freedom is here in a minute. But in 1666, in 1667, a synod was called that anathematize the old Russian prayer books and services and icons prior to that. It was a revolutionary synod. It did that by removing the synod of the 100 chapters from Ivan the Terrible. There was no good reason for this. But in a way, it completely rejected the notion of the Third Rome. The Third Rome was a nation. Now it was a Russian Empire or a Russian Federation. I want to note that the year 1666 isn't significant. That is not how Russians told time back then. So that wouldn't be relevant to Russia. I know it's exciting to try to connect the 666 to that synod, but there is no connection. Russia, of course, was on Byzantine time. And so that year would be 7174. 7175 over the course of the 365 days. They didn't now when Peter the Great took over, he changed that, and he removed the Byzantine calendar and began, which is figured from the time of Adam, to the modern calendar, which starts at the birth of Christ. So only then would 1667 matter at all. That is not how Russians figured time back then. St. Petersburg was Peter's revolutionary city. I've said this many, many times. I've said it 1,000 times over. I'm not going to repeat it. But its initial name, in Peter's mind, was New Amsterdam. That was the original name, and he thought better of it, worried about what the reaction to that's going to be. It's a bit obvious. But his reason for founding it was that Moscow is backwards. Moscow is ignorant. What he meant to say is that Moscow is orthodox. And he needed to get away from it as much as humanly possible. And he brought occultists all over Europe. There's many mainstream books on this topic. Again, I've dealt with this many times. The head of Peter's church, Feofan Prokopovich, was, well, he'd gone back and forth from Uniate to Orthodox. He, you know, essentially was a Lutheran with, you know, strong materialist and scientistic tendencies. He was a tyrant. Again, I've spoken about this many times on this show. And by the time Peter died in the 18th century, every single see in the Russian Orthodox Church had been purged, with bishops being tortured to death in many cases, sometimes by Peter personally, and replaced with his with those that he supported. And the old belief, of course, always stated that this is one of the many reasons that the Russian Church doesn't really have legitimate succession. That is to say, if succession is going to be based on that level of strictness. But there isn't a see in the Russian Church that wasn't replaced by Peter. The new rite, and Alexander Dugin spends quite a bit of time on this, the rite that Patriarch Nikon introduced, with a set of very dubious Greek prelates enshrined at that synod, was meant to harmonize the Byzantine rite in Russia with that of Serbia, Bulgaria, and Greece. What Nikon didn't know was that the Greek books that he was using were actually from Italy, done by Uniate presses. But a lot of people are very ignorant about what the old belief is. You know, most of us know the two-finger sign of the cross, or the two Alleluias, or the direction of the procession. Of course, those were a heck of a lot more important back then than they are now. But those were only symptoms of the greater cause. It's hard to imagine, but prior to the modern world, people in their day-to-day lives functioned according to ritual. Everything was a liturgy. You didn't just wake up and go to work and, you know, followed your whim. Everything you did was connected with some liturgical practice. Your entire life was organized that way. The most ornate, of course, was the Tsar himself. But there is not a move, literally not a move he made, that wasn't ritually mandated. And I've said this before, but the concept here, the ritual is a way to take an idea, something ethereal, and make it material without losing the purity of the ideal itself. We know that when an ideal is manifest in politics, human beings get their hands on it, bureaucracies get their hands on it, it ends up being distorted. It ends up being maybe destroyed much of the time. This has always been a problem. The ritual is the closest human beings can come to taking an ethereal idea and rendering it pure in the material world. The problem we have now is that most people don't know what those symbols are. Even Orthodox people, they love the liturgy and the churches, but they don't realize that every move, every piece of furniture, everything has meaning within either the life of Christ, the life of the church, or even the cosmos as a whole. This is all going on at the same time. The lowliest peasant in medieval Europe and old Russia knew this. He was very literate. Just not necessarily in words on a page often, although he had the missal memorized anyway. But he was literate in a far more important arena, and that is that of symbols. The old belief rejected the liturgy that Petrarch Nikon introduced in 1666, and of course the anathema against the old Russian theology prior to that, on the grounds that, well, on the grounds I just said, you can't change the liturgy without changing the ideal upon which it's based. Not only does it alter the theology, but it alters day-to-day life. Russian concept of freedom is identical to the concept of the sobor. Sloboda is a word. I remember Ronald Reagan made the claim that there was no Russian word for freedom. It's a stupid comment. You know, some speechwriter said that. But he's right in the sense that there's no word in Russian that refers to negative freedom. When an American uses the term freedom, he's referring to the ability to do whatever your passions desire, whatever your will demands, without external constraint. But that's a very alienated, you know, modern idea. That was inconceivable in the medieval or even early modern era. But even svoboda is a relatively late word in the Russian language. It's connected with freedom and truth. It's not to be a slave to your passions, but to be a master of your passions. I've said 1,000 times that there's a huge difference between freedom and autonomy, between freedom and independence. The negative concept of freedom really didn't exist. It was meaningless. That's a 20th century capitalist consumerist idea. If you have no external constraint and you're still being driven by your passions, then you're not free. The sva, it's in the beginning for the root term, means own or yourself, so to speak. The concept of svoistvo, the Russian word for estate, a much older Russian word for estate, or class, or position, role in society, is connected to the word for freedom. And that's interesting because it suggests that only within the community and your role in the community can you have any meaningful action. It's freedom and truth. It's never just a negative freedom, because the notion of not being master of your passions is the opposite of freedom. Now, the old believers believed that that freedom could be found in the fealty to Rome. Now, that's Rome as an idea, not as a place. The Talmud condemns Rome and Romans all over the place. They use different code words. You have to go to the encyclopedia to figure it out. But Antichrist, or this whole Adam Kadmon, you know, Jewish Messiah kind of thing, functions as a destroyer of Rome. The Ukrainian writer Zakharia Kopnitsky, in the Kievan era, actually predicted the coming of Antichrist in this period of time, but that this is a gradual conquest of the world by these forces. He even predicted there's going to be a period of time there's going to be a lack of sacraments, that everything's going to be taken away from an ungrateful Christian people. The old believers, as Alexander Dugin would say, were Russia, the purest manifestation of the Russian idea. The liturgy is a product not just of Byzantium and Bulgaria and even the old temple liturgy, and it's all connected, but small accretions connected to Russia's own experience. The liturgy is extraordinary. And Protestants who are alienated from the liturgy are alienated from their own culture and tradition because it's all congealed in liturgical forms. And you can't blame someone for not understanding it. It's a lot of work to extract all of the meaning in the symbols that the liturgy is manifesting. After a while, it gets easier. But when it's new to you and you're trying to connect one procession or one ritual action to an idea, it's a lot of work. But once you master it, you realize that this liturgy, this is a redemption of the cosmos. Nothing is arbitrary. And that's exactly what the old belief said. Freedom is impossible without the restoration of the cosmos from sin and death. The fall of old Russia in the old believer's mind came on Tsar Alexei's attack on the monastery of Solovetsky. After the synod in the 17th century, more specifically in 1668, in fact, it was an uprising that opposed the everything that the old belief eventually will fight. Centralization, the creation of this Russian papacy, and the introduction of Western forms of feudalism in the Russian context. And it's only a few years. The synod ended in 1667, the uprising occurs in 1668, and lasted until almost 1680. Finally, Solovetsky was the military stronghold of northern Russia. It kept the country safe from Swedes and the Livonian Knights and everything else. And it had fisheries and everything. It was very anti in Russian north. There was no feudalism. It's hard to do that in a sparsely populated area. There's a lot of wealth there, salt and fish. And they refused to bow to the new right and to the notion of the Russian papacy that Nikon seemed to support. And as much as anything else, when that synod anathematized the old ways and overthrew the 100 chapters for no good reason, it sounded like they were completely revolutionizing Russian thinking. This is exactly what they were doing. The sack of Solovetsky finally ended in 1676, led to the slaughter of many of the monastery peasants who came to defend it, and the blaspheming. I mean, it was a sack, no different than 1204. The Old Believer movement and its early, that's first generation, comes from the monks who survived that Solovetsky sacking, who then wandered around Russia, forming, a skede here, a hermitage there, highly literate, highly motivated men, spreading out slowly but surely from this northern fortification to everywhere else. In the first generation of the old belief, that's exactly what it was. Now, unfortunately, immediately two factions emerged. The first believed that grace cannot be entirely removed from the world, that this isn't the time of the Antichrist. It sounds, given the country that we live in now, that the old believers thought that was the coming of Antichrist is a little dramatic. And that's utopia compared to what we have now. So clearly, that wasn't the literal rising of Antichrist. As their opponents, those who believe that all grace was removed from the world. And that, of course, is the distinction between priesthood and priestless all believers. The Bezpovotsi, or the priestless, believed that there was no more sacraments because Antichrist ruled directly. They made the logical jump, and the logic is flawed, but because Antichrist rules directly, God has withdrawn his grace. Or God has withdrawn his grace, therefore Antichrist rules directly. The priestless split up into many, many sects. Those with priests did not. I've always been a supporter of Patriarch Alexander of Moscow. I believe he has a better claim to the patriarchal chair than his current occupant. Actually, it's a very large organization. I've spoken to many of his people before. But again, the central notion here is freedom, but freedom in the Russian sense. Freedom and synod are extremely similar. But what is the origin? The origin of the word synod or sobor is to connect. The old believers rejected any notion of dualism. Soul and body were the same thing seen from two different points of view. Our sinful state has to divide everything up so we can understand it. And there's, you know, nothing, you know, wrong with this concept. Inner, outer, essence, accident. You can't have one without the other. If you change something in the outer appearance of something, you will eventually change what's internal. These are not separate from one another. If you change the meaning of a word, and then over time change the meaning of your whole vocabulary, you're not going to see the world the same way. That the inner content and the outer form can't really be separated. They are constantly in this you know, dialectical motion. And if one is affected, the other will be affected. Therefore, changes in liturgy reflect and actually create changes in thought, changes in belief. Roman Catholics said this many times in the reaction to Vatican II. You can't change the liturgy and expect faith to remain identical. That's not how the human being works. The old belief was not about the correction of books. The founder of the movement, Avakum, was a book corrector. That was never a problem. There's always this process of correcting the service books. Now, this was rewriting the service. But not even that. It's rewriting the service in a historical context where Russia is changing radically. The nation is becoming an empire. The nation is becoming westernized. The liturgy is meant to reflect that, because now if Russia is going to take the Balkans and Greece and even the Orthodox parts of the Middle East, it's going to have a liturgy that everyone recognizes. And that really is the foundation of these liturgical reforms. And of course, it's all political. Liturgical reforms, serfdom, centralization of the state, westernized ways of thinking, nominalism, all of this are one movement. They're all connected. In defending the old right, they're defending old Russia in a philosophical sense. The basic understanding is that the new right, the right of Nikon, which is used in almost all Russian churches today, stresses hierarchy and obedience in an external mechanical way, where the old right stresses synodal freedom, freedom in the Russian sense. Family is the only social reality among the Orthodox, especially the old Orthodox, because the tribe would be the extended family. The table of ranks, which was the old hierarchy, the system of precedent in Russian government, wasn't just who gets to sit close to the czar, although this is what the history books will tell you. No, this is a development of tribal bonds, local histories. Peter the Great had all of this burnt and destroyed. The Duma, or the Russian medieval Vesha, was for the heads of tribes. That's how the Russian nation came into existence. The family, tribe, nation. Essentially all one thing developing over time. Peter interrupted that. Peter interrupted that because the new right interrupted that. 1682, Russia began yet another revolutionary upheaval. It doesn't get talked about very much. It was a time of Patriarch Joachim. Alexis had died. And Patriarch Joachim and the Duma elected Peter the Great, who was only 10 at the time. Tsar Alexis had married again after his wife had passed on. So there are two families now vying for power. The first was Miloslavsky and the second was Naryshkin. And Peter was of the Naryshkin background. So you had two families, both related to Tsar Alexis, and they wanted to kill each other. And it seems that the Miloslavskis grabbed onto the Old Believer movement to keep Peter from becoming monarch. The regent was his half-sister Sophia, who did mock the Old Belief. Many people call them ignorant peasants. They still do that today. She was regent from 1682 to 1689. But there was a revolt against Peter and that family right away. The minute this man was elected, it was as if the new right found its champion. There was an immediate revolt. It's like this demonic energy came into existence. The Streltsy, or the elite guards, the archers in Moscow, revolted and tried to depose Sophia. The archers were supporters of the Old Believers. Most people were supporters of the Old Believers. And of course connected to the Miloslavskis. Ivan Kolvansky was supposed to be put in his place as a prince and the head of this elite unit. And it was eventually put down with tremendous violence. I mean, extreme violence. Peter the Great saw this as a 10-year-old, and it changed him forever. The history books will say this is the reason that he never wanted to have anything to do with Moscow again, which is true, but it has no political significance. The new right had taken over Russia. It was associated now more and more with bureaucracy and centralization. And with someone like Peter, it fulfilled every apocalyptic prophecy that the refugees from Solovetsky had stated, almost, you know, like clockwork. Patriarch Joachim called a synod in 1681, 1682. He wanted to begin to build the church in the West. More bishops, more dioceses. There, of course, he thought the new rite would work because these are people who were used to the Greek usage, or what they thought was a Greek usage. This was not ancient Greek usage. Nikon believed that the Greek books that he was using, you know, went back to the apostles. That simply wasn't the case. They were actually quite modern. And the other thing he did was to declare war on the Old Believers. Especially after the Streltsy Rebellion meant that the state now was going to smash this movement. He considered the Old Believer movement a civil war. And so he said that when they get arrested, they're going to be handled by the civil courts, not the church courts. One of the main centers of the Old Belief was settled by the Solovetsky monks. And it was at Vik. And they actually turned out to be, you know, almost a lay monastic community in Russia. And they centered on the idea of Christian work in the midst of evil, in the midst of a dying world. It was a strict monastic life. They were based on, about 50% of the Vik monastery was from Solovetsky. The Vik refers to the Vik River in the Republic of Karelia. And it became the center of the Pomorian movement or the priestless movement, and really this intellectual, and with a physical center of the Old Believer movement in Russia as a whole. They had ironworks there, and this is one of the reasons that Peter the Great kept it going and didn't repress it. And as a result, they wouldn't engage in criticism of the monarch. Vig is one of the places that began to wonder early on if, in fact, the man who had come back from the great embassy in Western Europe was, in fact, Peter the Great. And the priestless or the more radical people, again, the grace had completely been removed from the world, were absolutely convinced of this. And this became an article of faith for them. Again, this is all Solovyetsky refugees, so they had this burning contempt for the new rite, which started this entire thing. They worried about the signs of spiritual death that they saw around them. And what that means is the spiritual death that modernity brings. Again, the new rite is about the forceful destruction of the medieval mind and the forceful introduction of the early modern. Signs of spiritual death, first of all, is the rejection of liturgy. That liturgy can be changed at will. That I could do it when I feel like. And it's often the case that it is a struggle. By the way, today is the Feast of the Dormition. And, especially when you're by yourself, liturgy, doing the liturgy all the time, it's very difficult. Motivation has to be there. That spark has to be there. But connected to that, the second thing is the lack of mutual aid. The slow, the connection of the word sobor really comes from the word to connect. When those connections, those bonds of trust begin to suffer, faith in God and faith among Christians falls apart. And the third is interesting, and this is the result of the first two, and that's parasitism. That the modern state, the modern world, creates a class of people who live according to rents. That they could use their political position to extract resources for no real value. And a usurer, for example, lives according to this. They're not producing anything. They're simply using their money to make more money. But this is all, this is part of the Vig idea, this is part of the old believer idea at the time, that they're seeing this as foreigners are being brought in to run Russia. Occultists and alchemists are being brought in from England and Germany. I've dealt with this elsewhere. The capital's moved to Petersburg, the floating city on the graves of the forced laborers that were forced to make it, the Cossacks, many of whom were all believers, by the way, and designed to revolutionize Russia. It was the conquest of nature, because there's no worse place probably in the world to create a city than in the swamps of northern Russia. Because ultimately, subornost is the principle of self-organization. Subornost, svoboda, all of these, even the word for estate, litsvo, all of this is connected, even with the concept of family. What ruled among the old believers, and even with the rest of Russia as well, the brotherhoods, guilds, the local sobor, this was essential. The old believer groups today, bishops don't have much power. One of the things the new rite introduced from the collapse of the church in the Balkans was a bishop as a little dictator and the complete lack of purpose of their local diocesan sobor. And there are people out there who never even think of the diocesan sobor. The bishop doesn't function on his own. The bishop refers to himself as we. He's a spokesman for the local sobor. And this is the deans, the abbots, the clergy, laymen. And the bishop really is only the overseer of that, the spokesman of that. Saint Eutherius of Moscow, or I'm sorry, of Solovyetsky, was one of the first the great writers in the Old Believer tradition, who said that Peter really is the solidification of all the decay and the destruction of that's occurred to all Russia over the last previous 100 years. Now, what is old Russia? What is this tradition that we're talking about here? What people often don't realize is that Russian wages, the value of the ruble, remained unchanged for centuries. That up until World War I, from this era all the way up to World War I, Russian wages relative to the standard of cost of living were far higher than Western Europe. From the 11th to the 20th century, they were at least equal to the wages of the West, probably higher given the fact it was a much it was more expensive to live there. From 1600 to, 1900, very little change. At this period of time, the average peasant owner averaged about 7 acres. Now, of course, they were part of a commune, but each family, you average it out, that's what they have. By 1917, it was the exact same. Even in 1800, serfs averaged between 3 and 4 acres. Tula was 2.4, Olenets was 7. This is what happens when you have a stable currency. This is what happens when you have a nation state that's focused on its central source of legitimacy. In the 18th century, Russian wages were twice that of France relative to the cost of living. You guys know I've written extensively on the Soviet Union, and one of the theses that I defend always is that the Soviets had no concern with labor whatsoever. That was simply, those were code words. Those were things to justify their behavior. And the proof of this comes from Oleg Platonov, that Soviet wages were 37% of GDP. In other words, of all of the value created, only 37% of that could be manifest in wages. That's the lowest in the world. That means that 2/3 of what they produced was taken by the state. That simple fact alone destroys any concept of the Soviets having anything to do with labor. But we're not talking about that here. The Code of Yaroslav in the Kievan era lays the groundwork for all of this. Loans exist for goodwill. They exist for Christian friendship. And the Old Believer merchant class, which was very powerful, had the same idea. They made profits, but they were never wealthy, because all the profits went back into the community. The only reason that the Jews did not entirely take over the merchant class of Russia was because of the Old Believers. And as always, whether it be the guild in Russia is called the Artel, which was, which owned the means of production. So there's no way a Marxist could have anything negative to say about it, but of course they destroyed it anyway. In the Code of Yaroslav, medieval Russia, repayment was done from the profits of it. See, today, if you give a loan, interest is charged, no matter whether you make a profit or not. The money is what produces the interest. In old Russia and many other places in the Middle Ages, it was what money creates. That's what creates repayment and the interest. So if it went under, then there was nothing left. Of course, you couldn't charge interest anymore, but there was no interest. Interest referred to the portion of the profits that the lender gave. So the ownership of capital was from the guild regardless. And this, the guilds were increasing substantially, even in the 19th century. Labor was seen as a moral act. And prior to the Soviet era, Russia had an excellent work ethic. There was no concept. You know, the old believer merchant classes became very powerful in the 18th and 19th century. And wealth could never be seen for its own sake. There was never anything outside of the community. And what saved these very huge old believer communities was his merchant class, despite the persecution of the Russian state against the old believers, you know, from 1666 to almost, you know, Decree of Toleration, 1905, it grew tremendously. About two-thirds of the Russian peasantry were a part of the old belief in one way or another. But changing the calendar, and we mentioned how, you know, 1666 notion has nothing to do with anything demonic because that's not how they told time. Peter the Great changes the calendar. You know, people forget what a revolutionary he was. Everything that the old the old believers said was going to happen, happened with him. They didn't realize it was going to happen so fast. The Soviet calendar was completely remade. There were two Jews who put it together, Pinkevich and Zelkind. It was 360 days, and they had five holidays at the very end of the year, which is very similar to the Egyptian calendar, by the way. So it was 72 five-day weeks. And, of course, there was no Sunday. There was no time off. This was the collectivist, Stalinist calendar that was designed to create the most exploitative system that the world has probably ever seen. We hear them using the word kulak, that this was the excuse to destroy peasant farms in the Stalinist era. It's actually used before then. But the concept really is, I mean, it's usually translated as fist. And in the American history, I've never seen an exception to this. They say that that means that the kulaki were tight-fisted. Well, they just invent that. Actually, the term is far more substantial and far older than these people realize. It's actually, the root is an alteration from a cyclical system to a linear system, which is, of course, what Marxism was. It's based on the notion of, well, it's also an insult. Kulak also means blockhead. It could also be translated as the mill wheel, which, of course, shows up in the New Testament, as we all know. It's actually a very intensely philosophical notion. The notion of this cyclical time, I'm sorry, this linear time, was created in the Petrine era, as far as Russia was concerned. For Christians, the year, the cycle of feasts, you know, this is a cyclical system. But believers in progress, and with a capital P, reject this notion completely. The Soviets did is take the old Russian concept of freedom, which is connected to the idea of the Sobor, the council, and pervert it entirely. You can't have freedom in this definition of the term if you don't have a community. And the collective farms, of course, were a parody of the old peasant communes. They were strangers thrown together under an overseer who was usually a Jew who knew nothing about agriculture and wasn't supposed to. His job was to make sure that Christianity was stamped out and that no surplus grain was to be had. The old believers always maintained that from the era of Peter on, the church began to decay slowly but surely. Peter the Great, as you know, abolished the office of patriarch and instead installed what he called a college of laymen that oversaw the Synod of Bishops. And as I said, the Synod of Bishops were of his own creation. And that completely dominated the financial side of the church. By the end of the reign of Catherine the Great, less than 100 years later, there wasn't a single source of income that the church could depend on, even candles. Candle money was the last source of income from Peter the Great to Catherine the Great in the 18th century. The church lost all of its property. Everything was secularized. Saints like Paul of Tobolsk and Arseny Matveyevich were murdered or sent into exile for opposing this. The number of monasteries after Peter died were less than half of what they were when he took over. Russian population had fallen. He is no less revolutionary than the Leninists. And because of this, the church weakens. By 1900, the Jews owned over 500 million acres of Russian land. They held loans by the westernized aristocracy, which is, again, a Petrian creation, and they foreclosed on them. In 1870, the percentage of merchants in St. Petersburg that were Jewish was 6%. 1876, it was 18%. In 1900, it was 60%. And this is how they did it. This was the purpose and the very nature of the new rite and the reforms. The church weakened to the point where overwhelmingly the church supported the government of Kerensky. Only a handful of hierarchs supported Tsar Nicholas in this crucial era. But it's all essentially one motion. Once the church had this new rite imposed on them, and the new westernized way of thinking, or I should say bureaucratic way of thinking imposed on them, its influence became less and less. It became formalized and mechanical. Now, of course, it created many saints. This is not, I'm not making an argument that there was nothing there. The Russian church did many extraordinary things this period of time. But especially in the 18th century, you have very few saints. You have a education system that was done in Latin. And this is because the old believers had been driven from the church. When you're best and brightest, when you're most literate and dedicated are thrown out, this is what you get. And we have the same thing with the old calendars. When the old calendars remove themselves from the church, for very good reason, what are you left with? Fighting from within is always an excuse to do nothing. That's always that's nonsensical. That doesn't happen. But when the old believers were, you know, they were slaughtered in huge numbers, especially in the era we're talking about. Church offices had a tendency to be filled with those who were willing to support either, you know, Peter or Catherine. So Alexander Dugin's conception of the old belief and the Petrian era is correct. It's the decay from nation to empire. That Russia had become the notion of the Third Rome, the pillar of freedom, because it was a pillar of salvation. But in Nikon's mind, Russia had become the illegitimate usurper of the Byzantine tradition. And in that way, using the Greek rites was to bring Russia closer to the Greek church. Again, little did he know that it wasn't the Greek church, that these were books created by Uniate Presses in Italy. This is what he wanted to believe. He did not speak Greek, but he was an extreme Greekophile. But what that meant was that the Thanar, the bankers, both Jewish and Greek, connected to the Turkish-controlled regime in Istanbul, ended up forwarding the money. This is who they were connected with, not ancient Byzantium. So in a way, the new rite did manifest the most salient aspects of Antichrist. Centralization, exploitation, the notion of personal gain, and rent seeking, which is identical to usury. This exploded once the new rite was solidified and the old was anathematized and the resistors at Solovetsky were slaughtered. So religiously, The church was held together by fear, especially in the 18th century. So you have Masonic usurpers like Byron and Ostermann, who actually ruled Russia behind the scenes. Weak rulers like Anna, or so-called Catherine I, and plundered the country for their own benefit. This could not have happened without the New Right. This could not have happened without the disastrous consequences of Nikon's so-called reforms. The Russian church did many, many great things since Nikon, but it's always been a crippled institution, and it took the Soviet Empire to finally force the church to lift all of these anathemas and to recognize the wrongdoing of the suppression of the old right. The old believers are Russia and should be seen that way. Thank you, guys. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.